Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to composer Chris Rowe about their work on Blue Jean. So happy to be chatting with you. I mean, when I saw that film, I kind of like stopped in my tracks for a second and was just, I knew that it was something special just from everything I had heard from months prior, but it was just like, it hit in such a visceral way that, I mean, like by the end, you're just kind of like, I don't really know what to do with myself. And I just remember it was like, I watched it at night and it was just maybe like 10:30 when it finished. And I was just like, I have a lot to process and a lot to journal now and a lot to write down, because it's just one of those films that just kind of completely absorbs you into their world. And I mean, and then spits you out at the end. And you just kind of don't know where to go after that. And so it's been interesting to sort of processes throughout the month. So
it's interesting to look back, isn't it, and like think what sticks with you from a film. I just find like, yeah, I often kind of completely forget the plot of films I've watched, but then it's just the feeling that sticks with you, isn't it? It was a great project to work on, and I agree, it feels very truthful as well. I think that's the when I first watched it, that was the thing that came across. It doesn't feel like overblown, or it feels like a snapshot in the woman's life, and then you don't really know where it goes afterwards. Has a real impact. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, speaking of feelings, I mean, like, what feeling did you, once you're finally fully wrapped on this project, I mean, and seeing it on the big screen, I mean, what was that feeling like for you, and watching the story and watching all of this work that you had done? And I mean, what was the first sort of initial reaction that you got?
Yeah, I mean, when you're working on a project like this, you're so wrapped up in your own kind of aspect of it, your own world. I had to keep the first time I watched the cut, it was actually quite far along. Just trying to remember that feeling that I got from the film the first time I saw it, which is just, you know, in awe of Rosie's performance, and just kind of, you know, it struck me really cold, trying to put myself in Jean's shoes. And so I think you kind of get wrapped up in your own world as you get deeper and deeper into the process. Thinking about the micro details of the music and getting kind of wrapped up in that. And so then to take a step back and, you know, after the film is complete and my role's done on it, and it was nice, I had like a month or two maybe of not seeing the film, and then I went to see it at the Venice Film Festival where it premiered. And obviously it's a great place, it's really exciting to be anyway, but just the atmosphere when they showed the film was just really charged, you could tell, and it got like a 5-minute standing ovation in the theater, and was just, yeah, really, you know, I'm guilty of this, like working on a project, you do like constantly have to remind yourself to take a step back and think of the bigger picture, because you know, I hadn't met these the two women that the film is kind of loosely based on, their stories, Sarah and Catherine. I hadn't met them before, and they came to the premiere, and I spoke to them and saw how they were in floods of tears. It was, you know, they went up and hugged Rosie for like 10 minutes, and it was, you know, hadn't quite clocked the impact that it would have on their community, and the way that it could tell that this story hadn't really been told before. And also that they hadn't had a kind of sense of, there'd be no sense of justice for them. I think that it hadn't been like a big campaign that was in the, you know, in the public eye really. And so for them, it's like a moment of recognition about the Section 28 law and like repealing it. And yeah, so it was a really emotional experience to see it premiere there. And now, you know, it's going stateside and getting great reviews. And it's always, you never know how things are going to play in out there in different countries and with different audiences. So yeah, it's great to see.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't know you were at Venice. So that, I mean, the height of that in terms of a first watch. I mean, that is incredible to hear. And I mean, just to have that reaction. I mean, usually you can just go to a theater, watch it, and then walk out and sort of process it on your own. But to have that be the first time you really see it in front with an audience is just, I can only imagine being mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. And you pick up different, you know, like people laugh in different places. There's not many laughs in this film, but like you do, it's a charged atmosphere in a theater, isn't it? And you don't quite know how people are going to react to certain moments. And I've seen it on a number of occasions, like with different audiences now, and it's always a different experience, and I see more each time. So it's a great place to see it for sure.
Mm. And I was thinking about this question last night as I was preparing for this interview. And I'm curious for you, I mean, do you remember the first film that you watched where you really noticed the composition and the score and just the music? Because I was having that realization last night, and I was thinking it's actually Finding Nemo, which is very strange. But I remember watching it, then buying the soundtrack on CD and then playing it like in my room as like a, I don't know, as a sort of calm me down sort of. And then there's of course like the shark chase and all that, but it was just interesting to process that through my head last night. So I'm curious if for you, what was that instance?
Yeah, no, it's always a, you always try and come up with a, whenever I think about this kind of question, it's, you always want to come up with like something really recent or really cool, or but it's always something from your childhood, right? So I mean, for me, it was, I used to watch the one thing you don't get now, I guess, is DVD extras, and like they used to do great features on the score. And so that was like one of the first times, I guess, that like, see, because I loved jazz and also orchestral playing, and like loads, I was kind of really involved in music making from a young age. But when you're watching films, you're not kind of consciously aware of it. But seeing the behind the scenes process like that kind of opened up my eyes to like the nuts and bolts and the mechanics of it, I guess, which was kind of exciting to see how it was put together. But then there's a great score for the film The Village, I loved again, it's one of those films that I can't really remember too much about the plot, but just the feeling it gave me, and it doesn't seem to get much praise now, but it's I loved the score in that film because it was all based around a kind of a solo violinist. I can't remember the violinist's name, but it's very direct link between like a solo violinist and the lead character, and kind of the struggle she went through. And I mean, it's a beautiful score just in its own right, but the way that kind of metaphor, I guess, and that like direct link between what was on screen and the kind of conceptual idea of like one instrument taking on the struggles of like of the lead character. I remember that kind of igniting something in me. And yeah, and then from then on, I think you do just kind of then start to tune into the soundtrack. But I'm the same, I guess. Like I, the best film scores are the ones that you end up, I think, you know, not really being aware of. If you're too aware of them, I think they're not doing their job. And so I've definitely been watching things. I think it's a good sign when I've been watching stuff and like haven't noticed where that cue started, or you know, the when you don't notice the mechanics of it, that's a good thing, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are obviously some movies that, I mean, sort of thrive off the bombastic nature of their score, but I mean, I think the films that sort of stand the test of time, that you really sort of think over and over about, I do think are sort of those more subtle, that you, the ones that you don't notice as much. So I completely agree with you there. But in regards to the film at hand, I mean, you came onto this project later, and maybe not later in terms of other projects that you have done in the past, but I mean, what were the conversations with Georgia like in terms of what the expectation was, what the mood and the essence of what was going to be built out for this film going to be?
Georgia's an amazing director, like so, and writer, and so talented, and she has, you can tell that she just had every aspect of this film, like she'd been living and breathing it for so long, you know. I always find that so impressive. And so I mean, from, yeah, they were quite far along. The good thing was that her and Izzy Curry, the editor, had tried out lots of temp score along the way through the editing process. Often in films I'd been involved much earlier, and so that you can become the temp is quite useful. But then the good thing about this was it was quite a hard balance. They'd struggled to find the kind of scale of the music, not too dark, not too light, not too big, because you know, when they tried things, because Rosie's performance is so kind of nuanced and subtle but powerful, I think the first instinct is to kind of overscore it and they were putting on stuff that was way too dark and ended up, you know, it ends up kind of overwhelming what's on screen. But then if you go too much the other way and go too kind of light, and then it sort of underplays the drama. So I think the fact that they'd gone through that process quite a lot without me in some ways was good, because that you can be much more brutal with, you can throw things away, you know, when they're not, when it's temp and it's not yours. And so in terms of like, they had, I think a good, you know, that they sort of liked where the temp was going, but still wasn't, you know, it still definitely needed work. And so what Georgia did, we kind of worked remotely because she lives in Spain, mostly. And so she sent me these amazing voice notes, and you could hear the beach in the background, you know, it was very kind of idyllic, maybe very jealous of where she lives, but you have this, she was very specific in what she wanted, I guess, what she felt each, she went through scene by scene, you know, what she wanted the audience to feel at the end of it, so in some ways very specific, and you know, sometimes what she liked about the temp, what she didn't like about it, but never got into the specifics musically. And so she left a lot of like all the freedom in the world for me to explore of how to achieve that feeling. And throughout the whole process, she was always very open to, you know, actually the instrumentation and things was ended up being quite different to the temp score. And so yeah, she was this great combination of being very kind of specific in what she wanted emotionally, but leaving it up to me, you know, how we got there. And then it was a lot of back and forth and you know, a fairly quick process, but we kind of landed on this the sound of the film really is this like very delicate string writing as well as a solo saxophone. And that was kind of my, I always try and find a conceptual way into the into a story, into the film. And I was kind of thinking about Gene's character having to lead this split life, you know, day and night, and her kind of being at school and having to be very repressed and hide that aspect of her life. And then, you know, at gay clubs in the evening and with her girlfriend Viv. And for me, there was that kind of that side of her was where she was at her most free, and but had to, but most of the film, most of the score is about those moments where she's being society is kind of creeping in and repressing her. And so I chose these instruments, they both, you know, both strings and saxophone have a lot of kind of innate, like we associate them with really strong emotions, I think, and lots, and particularly saxophone, you know, jazz, really unbridled freedom and creativity and expression. And but then they're actually played very delicately and very distantly throughout the film, until apart from some moments, like there's like a dream scene in the gym where the saxophone is kind of going crazy, and then at the end as well, towards the end, where Jean kind of breaks down laughing, crying after the party, where she's just finally kind of come out to her, or like admitted in a kind of public setting, you know, like I'm a lesbian. And there's this great and yeah, the music, then the saxophone almost like escapes and like is really free and able to express itself. And so I guess the process really with Georgia was a lot of back and forth, and it was really great. I actually, the first time I met her was at the recording session. She came along to the recording in London, which was great to have her in the room, because she could kind of push. She said, oh, why don't we try that, you know, even more fragile, even softer with the strings, and really kind of pushing that in a way that, you know, musically, it's not something you kind of, you want people to play in a certain way. And but thinking about the story, she was able to kind of really take a step back and push it even further. But yeah, no, she was a fantastic director to work with, yeah.
Mm. And I mean, working on Rosie's character, I mean, I'm curious, I mean, there's multiple instances throughout the film where, I mean, the scenario could change in terms of the way that, I mean, she's deciding what she wants to do. Like, does she want to make this decision to come forward and sort of liberate herself? And the moment could, the saxophone moment could have happened much earlier on. But in terms of, obviously you're not with the score trying to like guide someone to a certain feeling in a sense, but like, how are you playing that wire act of, I mean, you obviously know what's coming ahead, you as the composer knowing everything that is happening, but how are you sort of playing that fine line of just balancing what's happening with this complex character, but also sort of knowing what's happening in the next 5 seconds, but also in the next sort of like 15 minutes?
Yeah, about the pacing of it. And I mean, I with this film, I did score it from beginning to end. So it's not, might sound obvious, but I often I would start at the kind of, like with After Love, the film I did, that was all, I started at the end and kind of fragmented it backwards really to the beginning. But with this film, I think I hadn't thought about it, but it's, I think, you know, to go on that journey with Jean is really important. And because it was a relatively quick process scoring, obviously I had read the script and I'd seen the curtain, so I knew what was coming, but I felt like I could sort of live with Jean as she went through the story, because I was kind of writing it you know, like in quite an intense period of working. But yeah, I mean, I suppose there are lots of moments in the film where, yeah, that moment maybe could have arisen, like that moment of freedom. But a lot of the score, I think, is in the setting of her kind of day-to-day life at school. And I think a big job that we wanted the score to do, really, the heavy lifting for the score, was to kind of represent society and like the pressure building up, gradually building up. So there's a lot of these scenes where they chose to do a kind of zoom in, a gradual zoom on Jean's face. And I remember Georgia talking about this and how that was a real decision they'd made to use that technique. And so musically, we kind of wanted to give a sense like the walls closing in. And so there's one scene where there's like this build, this low kind of drone that you really hear in the cinema when you see it, but it kind of really builds up like this building pressure on her character. And so a lot of the string writing, a lot of the synths I used were kind of that sense of sort of creeping paranoia, really, that Jean feels. Because there's the challenge, I think, when they were temping the film and also in scoring it, was there's no kind of big tragic event that happens. It's lots of subtle, you know, for Jean, she obviously feels it, and but there's no, you know, there's no murder, there's no like big kind of event like that to kind of work, go towards. So I suppose it, and that's why I think if you went too far, if you went too dark, it kind of overplayed it and lost its power. So yeah, it was a delicate balancing act between that throughout the film. Yeah.
Mm. And I mean, what would you say was the biggest challenge for you?
I mean, I think it is that it is trying to find music that feels like it comes out of that it already exists in the world that you're scoring. So I never want music to feel like it's just been put on there. And I think trying to kind of coexist with the like 80s soundtrack, that is great, by the way, like some great tunes they've chosen. Trying to find music that kind of sat alongside that neatly, but was clearly of a different world. And like, so I guess it's trying to, for me, that's like the two sides of Jean's life, you know, it's her kind of split life. And so, yeah, trying to, you know, if we went like full orchestral, lush score, it would feel so different from that 80s soundtrack that it would feel like it's been put on there, I think, because the 80s soundtrack already exists.
Yeah,
it already feels like it's really authentic, and like the rest of the film, by the way, is just so, it just looks perfect. I think like it doesn't look overly 80s, but you just believe that you're back in the 80s. I think like the costume design and the way it's shot, and yeah, it's just fantastic. But so musically, I, you know, wanted to kind of join with that world by using kind of some synths from the time, and that was the kind of, I think, the most obvious point where it's kind of 80s influence like that is in the is in that dreamscape scene in the tunnel, where everything kind of slow motion, and it's one of the rare kind of stylized moments in the film, I guess. And the Prophet 5 synth that I've got like comes into its own. But so that was the kind of link, I guess, that was the glue between those two sound worlds. There's lots of tricks you can find I love finding like little sound effects in the film that you can hide the entry of a queue or exit, you know, like when they go down to the beach on Viv's motorbike, you can hear the seagulls in the background at the end, and the music kind of tails out on the same note as the seagulls. So you kind of like, it all becomes part of the same world, hopefully.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. It's kind of like the score, or the, not the score, the soundtrack is sort of like the external, like, this is what, I mean, you're, it's like setting the stage for what you're about to sort of present in the internal world of what Jean is feeling and where she is at every moment. So I that's really interesting to sort of glue those sort of different parts together. Didn't quite think of before. But I mean, final question for you, just since we're almost at time, I mean, what do you, I mean, ultimately take away from this film? And I mean, what do you hope that, I mean, audiences take away from this film as it continues to roll out and as it continues to grow and find its audience?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it finds, you know, wide, it has found a wide audience, which is great, because I think it just, it was a, you know, specifically about Section 28, I was just so unaware. I mean, it's not like, it's not my story to tell. And, you know, maybe it's been a bigger story in other people's minds, but I feel like speaking to Sarah and Catherine, it's something that's been kind of brushed under the carpet, that time. And also, but it's so not, complete, like it's not history, right? It's homophobia definitely still exists, and it's that realization, I think, that like homophobia isn't just obvious, you know, like homophobic attacks or you know, kind of things that you can black and white kind of definitely see as homophobia. It's the kind of microaggressions and the subtle way that you treat people, and I hope it kind of brings across how, and even if it's, some of it is, you know, it Jean gets like really paranoid through the film, but it, it's seeing that effect that it can have on people is really powerful, I think, and kind of switch and makes you kind of live in their shoes. And I, you know, I just hope as a film itself, it reaches as far and wide as possible. It's great that it's now, yeah, in the States, and you know, will kind of propel Rosie to stardom. Like it's surely, it's like she's a breakout star, like and Georgia as well. I can't wait to see what she does next. I hope everyone goes to see it.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery, but a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.